KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Arkan Fung, the Ford Foundation Professor of Democracy and Citizenship at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. Arkan is a prolific writer and author in a space that we have discussed on the show from time to time, but we're going to spend the entire hour discussing, which broadly stated is transparency and accountability in government, but more specifically transparency and accountability as it relates to issues involving technology and how technology can be used to further that kind of transparency. The specific focus of our discussion is going to be a chapter that Arkan has co-authored with David Weil in a book that O'Reilly put out last year called Open Government, Collaboration, Transparency, and Participation in Practice, which was edited by Daniel Lathrop and Laura Ruma. In that book, Arkan and David, and David's not joining us today, but Arkan has co-authored this chapter entitled Open Government and Open Society, where the authors take a look at the question of where we are in thinking about transparency today. And this is a topic that has gotten a good amount of attention in the last few years, where received wisdom with regard to transparency and more specifically the idea of sharing information has been challenged a little bit. Not challenged from the standpoint of saying we shouldn't, but perhaps more specifically challenging it from the standpoint of saying, are there areas where in fact we want less transparency, or more specifically, we want to tailor transparency to particular scenarios. This issue, of course, has become significant and has been brought to center stage by WikiLeaks, a topic that we're going to be focusing on this quarter. In fact, next week I'll be interviewing Micah Sifry regarding his book WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency. WikiLeaks is part of the broader discussion, which ultimately centers around the question of where technology leaves us today. And Arkan's work over time has looked at this issue very closely. He's written a variety of books on the topic, including Full Disclosure: The Perils and Promise of Transparency, which remains one of the leading books in the field that focuses on these issues. In the past, I've had on the show other experts in the field, including Al Roberts and Kristen Lord, who have written about this topic as well. And today we're going to drill down on this question of technology. What do we mean by open government? What do we mean by transparency? What do we mean by a phrase that Arkan has used, targeted transparency? And then where does it leave us? And what role and questions can technology help us answer? Technology, of course, the internet, being a medium which obviously, and it's a cliche, allows for greater dissemination of information, and dissemination of information in ways heretofore unseen can be harnessed in ways to improve transparency and accountability. And the question is how to do that and what those contours should look like. So I'm excited to have Arkan on the show today. By way of brief background, as I mentioned, he is a professor at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. He has been at Harvard for several years. In addition to Full Disclosure, he also published the book Democracy Unbound: Solving Dilemmas of Modern Politics. I could spend the next 15-20 minutes running through all of his publications, but suffice to say that he's published internationally on these topics. And the bottom line is he's a terrific guest for the show, and I'm excited to have him on. So Arkan, who is joining us via Skype from Boston, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks a lot, Dave. It's a pleasure to join you on the show, and I look forward to our conversation about transparency and technology.
I appreciate it. Arkan, let me start off with a question that I ask most of my authors, which is to talk a bit more about your background and the genesis of your interest in open government.
So my background is I've been trained in political science and political philosophy, and most of my work is on citizen participation in different ways. And I got interested in the question of open government kind of in a little bit of a roundabout way. In the, I guess, the early 2000s, there were a group of people at the Kennedy School who I eventually became very close to and with whom I work a lot in a continuing way. And one of those is a co-author that you mentioned, David Weil, and the other is Mary Graham. And in the early 2000s, we began to have a series of informal conversations about different kinds of policy issues, about environmental regulation. Mary was especially interested in environmental regulation. David is a labor economist and so especially interested in workplace issues, wage and hours regulations and informal work and production and questions like that. And we discovered that there was a common thread running through our interests, but also policies in the world. And that common thread is that increasingly governments at the federal level and the state level in the United States, but also internationally, were turning to information as a tool of regulation. And so you ordinarily think of regulation as government passing laws that will fine people or put them in jail if they do the wrong thing, or maybe provide some incentives, create some provide some rewards, positive incentives, pay them to do things that government wants them to do. Well, a new development, or a relatively new development, is that regulators had begun to use information, the public release of information, to induce corporations and public service providers to do a better job to protect against public risks and public safety, public risks, improve public health, improve the quality of services. And so that's how we all kind of got interested in information as a part of public policy.
This idea of information as regulation is an interesting one, and of course, you know, it's a topic which is of increasing importance, and one that we, you know, have been discussed by legal scholars, certainly in the context of works like Larry Lessig's Code, but also Yochai Benkler's work on networks and so forth. And I'm curious to get your perspective as someone, and I should be clear about this, since many lawyers listen to the show and we talk about law, that you are not a lawyer by training. But obviously law plays a role here. I'm curious to get your perspective on information as a regulator or as a form of regulation. And through what prism do you view that?
Yeah, so, you know, I am not a lawyer and I don't have a law degree, but some of my best friends are lawyers, and I admire the work of Larry Lessig and Yochai Benkler enormously. I mean information based regulation in a much more literal way than either Larry or Yochai do. And so let me just give you a couple of examples that are that don't really have much to do with technology, but just focus on the information as a regulatory tool. So your show is in California, and probably some of your listeners go to LA from time to time. And the next time you go to LA and you eat out, you'll notice that on the front window of every restaurant is a letter grade that's posted A, B, or C. And that letter grade reflects the latest health and safety inspection of that restaurant's kitchen. And so everywhere in LA, there's a law that requires these restaurants to put that information up on their front window in a very public way. And so that is that's a very simple, very elegant, and I believe very effective form of information as regulation, right? So there, what the health department is doing is using the power of, in this case, the power of the public acting as consumers to help them do their job by putting pressure on restaurants that have dirty kitchens or inspected to have dirty kitchens, and rewarding ones that do better, that have cleaner kitchens, with namely those that get an A grade. So that's a very, very simple example of how regulators use information to do their job.
So we think of this, and well, I'll ask you, I mean, should we think of information in this context as having a signaling function, not only to in the context of consumers, but more specifically for purposes of our discussion today, a signaling function to citizens of democracies?
It issues it is a signaling function. It signals a public judgment, or in this case, a government judgment. But that's one way to view it. I guess I view it in a different way also, as the public using its state power to gather and disseminate information that in turn the public can use to protect itself or to advance other values other than kind of risk protection that it has. And so to me, it's transparency can be a very intelligent use of the authority of government.
The context of our discussion being transparency, it's helpful, especially since these are terms that kind of get bandied about without clear definitions. So we're not sure what these things mean from time to time. And certainly we can question whether policymakers know what these terms mean specifically. Let me ask you to define a few terms that we're going to be using today. And the first one is one that you hear all the time, open government. In your mind, what does that mean?
So, to me, open government means it's a movement and a set of policies and an impulse by which people in government, policymakers, legislators, other public officials, make available to the public information in government's possession. In which public officials make available information that is in the government's possession to the public. And it's usually, but not always, information about how the government operates, if that makes sense.
It does. And by how the government operates, we're not just, of course, talking about how many people work in a given department, but we're speaking more broadly about the kinds of decisions that the government makes and the process by which it goes through.
Yeah, oftentimes open government information deals with the process of policymaking and decision making. So here, open meetings laws are an example that most people are probably familiar with that go back a long, long way in this country. Another example is information, or another kind of open government is information about money that the government spends. And so one of the largest open government programs, I believe, of the Obama administration is recovery.gov, and another one is usaspending.gov, which are two websites that make available to the public a vast amount of information and data about where public dollars are going.
Another term that you use, and you use it, of course, in the title of the chapter that we're going to be discussing today, is open society, which is broader than open government. So well, what does that entail in its broadest scope? And we'll drill down in more detail later.
Yeah, so the way that David and I use the term open society is not actually a standard usage of the term. I think when most people think of open society, they think of a free society, one in which there's free speech and freedom of association. Here, however, or in the essay that you referred to, we use open society in contrast to open government. Okay, so I just said that open government is a movement or a belief and a set of policies that make it public information about how government operates. David and I use open society to denote a set of policies and an impulse that focuses on making information about other organizations and entities in society more publicly available. So open government is one possibility or one kind of transparency. Another kind of transparency is open society, in which government uses its power to make entities in society more transparent. And here we're thinking largely, but not exclusively, the activities of corporations.
And that's a fascinating area about which I've written in the narrower context of trade secrecy and intellectual property. And I want to return to that, but I do want to ask you to define two more terms. And again, these are bread and butter terms that exist in these conversations, and yet it's fascinating how the definitions can vary. Transparency and accountability, again, have broad definitions. How do you define those ideas?
Yeah, so transparency I take as a broader umbrella term that includes both open government and open society. And transparency policies are measures that make public information about the behavior of individuals or organizations or groups that otherwise wouldn't be available. That is, transparency measures compel individuals or organizations to tell the public things about how they operate or what they do that they wouldn't otherwise tell the public. And accountability is, I use the term accountability to denote the requirements that some entity, a public official or a private actor, provide an account, that is an explanation of their actions that is usually kind of with reference to commitments that they've made earlier, promises, implicit or explicit kinds of commitments.
And I assume that your definitions dovetail nicely with the deliberative democracy ideas that have been written about extensively in the last 10, 15 years. And again, perhaps for the benefit of listeners, tell me if I'm correct, and how deliberative democracy would fit into that equation.
Yeah, I have worked a bit on deliberative democracy, and deliberative Democrats often consider publicity and public information an important component of a deliberative governance and a successful deliberative rule, by deliberative popular rule. They haven't focused a huge amount of their attention on the specific issues of transparency and information and when in what kinds of information are justified in terms of requiring public information requirements and what kinds of provisions generate good or bad effects and so on. So it's related, but not exactly overlapping or the same thing.
Fair enough. One more definition before we dive in more specifically, which is a phrase that you've used in this chapter and you used in Full Disclosure, which is targeted transparency. And that gets us to this, to I think a more fine-grained analysis of what we want to be transparent. Can you give us what's that definition of targeted transparency?
Okay, so one way to think about different kinds of transparency is targeted transparency versus general transparency. And so a lot of the literature about transparency and open government discusses measures like the Freedom of Information Act, which allows any citizen to file a request with government for any piece of information that government possesses. And so that's a generalized kind of transparency, right? It covers all sorts of information, all sorts of policies, all sorts of different parts of government. So a lot of transparency and openness policy is about is general in nature. By targeted transparency, Mary Graham and David Weil and I mean policies that are targeted in two respects. One, they target a specific area of social life or political life or public life, like the LA restaurant example that I gave you, right? That's very targeted to one kind of problem, restaurants that that have dirty kitchens or the cleanliness of restaurants. Also, their targeted transparency policies are targeted in a second sense. We mean a second sense in which they're targeted, and that sense is that they are targeted to achieve some particular public objective, like the increasing public health or reducing financial risk or increasing equality in some way. So they have to, targeted transparency policies are targeted to specific policies or specific areas of life, and then they also have specific policy objectives, whereas general transparency policies often do not.
And so that leads us, and we're chatting with Professor Arkan Fung of the JFK School at Harvard regarding his book chapter with David Weil, Open Government and Open Society. Arkan, that leads us, I think, into a more specific discussion. Now, you know, we think about transparency along these lines. In order to frame our discussion, particularly of this relationship between open government and open society, how would you define the current state of U.S. governmental transparency, of open government? And I'm not asking for a report card as much as where we stand today.
Yeah, so I've been a little bit critical about the status of open government and the open government set of open government initiatives that have been pursued over the last 2 or 3 years for a couple of reasons. But before I get into the criticism, let me say that I do think that open government is by and large a good thing. Citizens do have a right to know what their government is doing as a matter of being able to exercise their democratic prerogatives. However, I think that the enthusiasm for open government has suffered from a couple of blind spots. And let me talk about those two blind spots. One blind spot is that open government, as I said, focuses on the operations of government largely oftentimes to the exclusion of other kinds of actors. And to my mind, so think from the perspective of a citizen, you, Dave, or me, in our lives, say, what should our priorities for transparency be? And I think it's important for us, for any of us, to have the kinds of information that allow us to live our lives well, to protect ourselves individually and collectively against different kinds of risks that we face, to make good decisions, economic decisions or consumption decisions or investment decisions or social decisions or whatever it is, right? And so with that in mind, I think our efforts, our collective efforts in transparency and securing information and processing information should be directed toward those entities, those large entities that create the greatest sources of risk for us. So are you with me so far?
I am.
Is that clear enough?
Yep.
And if we were living in societies or periods of history in which government was the only actor, the predominant actor in our lives and created the most personal or political or physical kinds of risks, and you can name countries around the world that fit that description, then I think the lion's share of energy should be devoted toward making government more transparent to allow citizens to protect themselves from government. However, in the United States and in other advanced industrial democratic societies in Europe and other places, I don't think the description I just gave fits very well. And government government does pose some risks to us, but I think many more risks or as many risks come from other entities in society, the banks that we depend upon to organize and invest the wealth that we create, to the companies that produce the goods and services upon which we depend, and so on. I think that many risks that we face come from those entities, whether or not cars are safe, whether or not spinach or bean sprouts have E. coli, whether or not banks make responsible lending and fair lending decisions, and so on, right? All of those actions are dependent on private organizations, and a huge amount of our risk and welfare is dependent on the activities of those organizations. And so therefore, I think that it's appropriate that in our society, the collective efforts to get information, to aggregate information, and to process information ought to be directed, a large portion of that effort, to making those organizations, that is private sector organizations, corporations, more transparent. However, in the current state of the debate, when people talk about transparency, they usually mean government transparency, right? Or transparency of government. And so I think that the lens of transparency is a little misdirected. So it's okay. So maybe I should pause there for a second.
No, you've said a lot there, and I have some follow-up questions. We're chatting with Professor Archon Fung of the Kennedy School at Harvard, and I should note they were recording this show on June 27th for airing in the first week in July. Archon, turning the lens specifically on commercial transparency, which is the focus of this chapter as well as some of your other recent work, we don't think much of commercial transparency. And certainly the law is, I think, in large measure, it's built into the law and built into, I think, perhaps our views of corporate entities generally is that they are going to be secret first. You know, we have disclosure rules in the securities laws, and we have other areas where, in a targeted way, to use your word, corporations need to be transparent. But for the most part, we orient corporations towards secrecy, whereas government, at least as conceived in democracies, is increasingly oriented towards transparency as being the default. Does that default position matter? In other words, first of all, am I framing it correctly in your mind? But then does it matter, and how much does it matter, that corporations by default are viewed as being capable of and should keep a lot of secrets, whereas government generally should not?
I think the default position is, it's very important to understand. I would urge that we question that default position and instead adopt a more consequentialist position, a kind of brutally consequentialist position that says, well, you know, what do we value? We value the minimization of public risk. We value welfare and efficiency and effectiveness. And from that starting point, what kinds of openness and what kinds of secrecy ought to be preserved in order to advance those values? And if we begin from that starting point, I think you'd have to give a bunch of ground on the default on both sides, both on the governmental side and on the corporate side. You know, I wanted to say a little bit more about the state of open government.
Please.
And, you know, one reason for being a little bit critical is what I said before, which is that the lens of transparency, or the flashlight, the spotlight of transparency, if you will, by my lights, is a little bit misdirected because of its focus so strongly and almost exclusively on government. And so I think the spotlight needs to be broader or shift, the beam needs to be redirected. However, there's a kind of perverse consequence of open government, which is the following. So a lot of the open government and transparency discourse right now is about transparency for accountability. That is, there are laws and measures and systems like recovery.gov and USA Spending and so on that are directed to make government more transparent. But not just generally more transparent for the sake of holding it accountable, and in particular, providing the kinds of information that will allow citizens or journalists or other kinds of watchdogs to catch government doing something wrong, whether it's fraud or corruption or in the language of the stimulus package, fraud, waste, and abuse, right? And so a bunch of open government is transparency for accountability. And accountability is important. It's a positive value. However, the perverse consequence of so much transparency for accountability may be the continuing delegitimation of government. And here's what I mean. So if we invest all of this effort in transparency to make government more accountable, catch government doing something wrong, that's a big part of open government right now. And then you marry that to two other elements of the information and media cycle. And the second element is journalists who are getting very good at using these data sets, but whose a main objective and a main part of the journalistic ethos and self-conception is as watchdog, right? And so they are trying to use this data to catch government doing something wrong as well. That's what counts as a good and important story, and they often are good and important stories. And then those stories are consumed by a public that is, by and large, quite cynical and negative about the potentialities of government. And so, you know, in public opinion polls, they ask people year after year, do you believe that people in Washington are acting in the interests of all or to advance the interests of just a few special interests. And in current surveys, it's a very high percentage, a large majority says that thinks that government is acting in the interests of a very few. And so one of my fears is that the kind of open government that we have, the current emphasis of open government on transparency for accountability, will just fuel this cycle of cynicism about government and so contribute to its continued delegitimization. And that creates a problem because for two reasons. One, yes, we should catch government doing something wrong, but government does a lot of good stuff too. And a full and robust transparency system would acknowledge that full range of good performance as well as bad performance. And so, however, our current transparency systems focus on government doing bad things. I kind of like to, I say that open government is a little bit like an Amazon rating system in which the government can only get one or two stars. It's impossible, or largely impossible, I think, under the current transparency arrangements for the public to kind of rate government as doing a four or five star job. So that's one problem, is it offers only a partial picture of government that may contribute to delegitimation. The second problem is that if you agree with me that more transparency of the private sector, open society in David and I's terms, is important, the only entity that can create an open society is a powerful government. And so by ironically, open government policies, to the extent that they delegitimate government, are also making it harder to create an open society.
We're chatting with Professor Archon Fung of Harvard University and Kennedy School on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU-FM Stanford, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on donate. Regardless, we hope that you continue listening to the station and that you continue listening to Hearsay Culture. You know, this idea, Archon, of the uses of information for positive purposes rather than negative ones is of course, you know, I mean, perhaps sadly, somewhat unusual. And it's not, and I think not only the muckraking, which is diminished, I suppose, among journalists, but also the general cynicism towards government is amplified here. If we take those same principles, or let me put it another way, can we take those same concerns and apply them to corporate entities? In other words, do you conceive of an argument that applies the exact same way with respect to corporations, or are there differences?
I don't think the arguments for transparency apply the exact same way for corporations. And I think in order to make transparency policies successful, you have to look at particular areas and problems that you'd like to make more transparent. So if the problem is unsafe products that you're worried about, then that's one kind of transparency policy that appeals directly to consumers and so on. If you're concerned about larger decision-making within corporations or policies and behaviors that don't directly affect individual citizens, like investment decisions and so on, then I think you need different sets of transparency policies. But I guess I also think that that same logic applies on the governmental side, right? That that the kind of transparency you want depends a lot on what kind of government activities one is trying to make more transparent.
With regard to open government, you not only you've been concerned about what we mean by it, but you've also written that open government advocates have missed the boat to some degree on going for an open society. So perhaps you could talk about the advocacy community and what you see as some of the issues there.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to say that the advocates the advocates who identify themselves as pushing for more open government and generalized transparency in that way do focus on government and are a little bit resistant to pushing as well for open society policies. And I'm not sure why that is, but I think that it's because it's relatively easy to get a consensus among people on the left and the right that government should be more open. However, when you start shifting the lens to making society, corporations, even individual behavior more transparent, then I think your allies on the political left and the political right begin to peel off for different kinds of reasons. And so it's just, I think, easier to mobilize politically around open government rather than open society.
Where does, in your view, the open business model ideas or the various forms of free software and collaborative work fall into this analysis? In other words, we see in intellectual property law and in innovation theory this movement towards open source. Is open source a subset of the kinds of open society issues about which you write?
That's an interesting question. It is and it isn't. It is because I think that production that occurs in open sourced, crowdsourced kinds of ways, those kinds of organizations are, I think, more in their DNA to accept requirements and even demands for openness. However, I think that the enthusiasm that has come from open source and crowdsource methods and developers and enthusiasts has, in a way, led open government in some directions or created policies that are a little bit too optimistic. My guess is that some of your readers are open source enthusiasts.
Undoubtedly, yes.
And I am
as
well. however, let me talk about a couple of ways in which the open source, crowdsourced enthusiasm may be misplaced in arenas of open government and in public policy and politics more generally.
Okay.
So I believe that some of the enthusiasm for open government around recovery.gov has come from people in the developer and even information regulatory community that are very positive toward open source and openness generally. One part of that enthusiasm, I think, is that if an organization or a government agency puts a lot of information out there, then good things will happen with it, right? And indeed, part of the open government principle, or at least a principle that many open government policymakers adhere to, is that they don't want really to try to guess what developer communities or citizens will do with open government information. It's government's job to put the information out there, and then people will use these data sets in all kinds of creative ways, right? However, I think that that's not exactly right, and oftentimes leads to some disappointment. And so U.S. stimulus spending, there was an enormous amount of effort put toward making those budgets and those contracts and the spending and the project details very, very transparent on websites that are lavishly funded and so on. And I think part of the expectation there is that many, many people would find interesting and important uses for that information. I would like to be proved wrong about this, but I think by and large, that hasn't really happened. And it hasn't really happened because I think the people who are for open government and pushing a bunch of this information out there, some of them haven't done the additional work of the thought experiment of exactly who's going to use this information and what they're going to use it for.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at the Massachusetts transparency website for the stimulus website, guess why of the people who visit the site, right? This is the site that makes the dollars that are going to all sorts of infrastructure projects and so on in Massachusetts more transparent. What are they trying to do? What do you think they're trying to do?
By going to the website?
Yeah. What are they? Why are they going to the website?
They want to find out if any money is being spent on their block.
No, they want a job.
Or they're just looking for a job. Oh, so I'm being too optimistic. Yeah.
People, maybe I'll go to the website and get myself a job, right?
Yeah.
and so the idea that somebody is gonna, you know, come home after a hard day at work, you know, load up a statistical analysis package on their machine, download this data set with 100,000 rows from a government website and crank on it is a little bit fantastical. And so you get people in government, very, very good people in government, who are effective in many domains and well-meaning and well-intentioned and so on, who are upset because your ordinary citizens aren't visiting their sites as much as they had hoped or they had liked. But then you think, well, why would they, right? What is the value that they're hoping to get out of that some citizen might get out of visiting recovery.gov or USA Spending? And then I think it's a short leap of reasoning or a short chain of reasoning is to say, well, the main users aren't going to be citizens like that. They're going to be very professional users, like journalists who are looking to write a story about some part of the stimulus, or watchdog organizations or advocates and so on. And those are going to be the main users. And that's okay, but it just would have, I think, saved everybody a lot of time to reason through it that way, rather than to say, well, you know, recovery.gov, USA Spending, those kinds of things are data sets for the general public as such, right? So it's a lot easier to tell a story about how the use of information in the LA restaurant disclosure example that I mentioned at the outset of this show, how that's going to really result in good things, namely less people getting sick. It's a lot easier to tell a story about that hangs together, than it is to tell a story about recovery.gov or usaspending.gov and how ordinary citizens will use that information to increase the efficiency or reduce the amount of corruption in government. And so I think that that it's really important that policymakers ask the second and third question about, well, who exactly is going to use this information? And is anybody going to use it? And what are going to be the consequences of that information? I think those are really important questions and hard questions to ask. And I think one tendency that grows out of the enthusiasm of open source developers and insofar as they're a component of the open government movements is not to ask those hard questions because they're already convinced that the information will do a lot of good, whereas that's the whole question.
We're chatting with Professor Arkan Fung of the Kennedy School at Harvard. You know, Arkan, to me, you know, and certainly this is colored by the prism through which I often view these issues as a lawyer and one that focuses intellectual property. To me, it's often a question of access to information. That is, who has access to it? And so to push back, I don't know if it's even pushing back, but to dig a little deeper on that point, one of the concerns that I've had with regard to freedom of information generally, and even transparency, is that we don't know ultimately who might find a given piece of data useful. And while I think it intuitively you're right that the likelihood of Joe average citizen taking a random data set and crunching it after work is indeed remote, there may be individuals or even entities who are not plugged into the right networks in order to access information, who may literally stumble upon information that would be useful to them via some kind of app, which we'll talk about in a moment, or just by going to a government website. Is that a concern of yours, that is access in particular for that serendipitous purpose, a concern of yours. And then the follow-up question is that likelihood or whatever likelihood is of that event occurring worth the price of having the kind of transparency that open government people envision, or many of them do?
I'm not quite sure what my own views are on that question. I think that I'm not against recovery.gov at all. You know, I think it's a good thing that information is out there. I think it's a good thing that a lot of campaign finance information is out there. And it's good in part because it creates the possibilities for the kind of serendipity that you're talking about, right? So I think that the serendipity is a real factor. And but I'm more worried. I'm not so much worried about the serendipity because I think that the current open government movement takes care of that handily. What I'm more concerned about is more deliberate effort on the part of policymakers and advocates to identify, to be self-conscious about the kinds of data that they feel are most socially valuable, and to have a clear account in their own minds about who's going to use that information and why their use of it will produce social value. So here's a little anecdote or an analogy that I use sometimes. So have you seen The Social Network,
yes,
the Facebook movie?
I have.
Yeah. So probably a bunch of your listeners have too. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in the movie
and the show also that you should know, of course, the KZSU signal very easily goes right into Facebook's offices.
No, very, very well. This is a congratulatory example.
Oh, there we go. That wasn't a warning, mind you. It was just a factual note. Go ahead. Yeah.
So there's a scene in the movie when Mark Zuckerberg's character is coming back from some bar or party, and he's thinking about how to design the front page of Facebook, and he has this epiphany, and the epiphany is we've got to have a relationship status field, and to me it's that moment. What would the early Facebook have been without a relationship status field? Is really, really important. And in that moment, what he does is identify a central value that the platform is going to provide for its users, right? And I think a bunch of these open government efforts would be improved if they sought self-consciously to have that relationship status field moment, that is to try to have some account, even an epiphany, about what the distinctive and powerful value that the platform will provide. And that's very, very different from the principled stance that we're not even going to try to make that guess. We're just going to provide the information and let people use it as they will and hope for a very productive serendipity.
And so with that in mind, Archon, and we have about 6 minutes left, which is what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I ask you questions that you no longer have an adequate amount of time to answer. And yet I use the host prerogative and ask them anyway. This conversation would not even remotely be complete, and I'm not suggesting it is in the short time that we have, without a mention of WikiLeaks, which to me seems like the prototypical example of the kind of indiscriminate transparency that some open government advocates push for, and indeed it seems like many supporters of WikiLeaks would agree with. Where do you come down on WikiLeaks in particular? Of course, I'm just speaking about their biggest leak of information, which is ongoing, involving the diplomatic cables.
Yeah, so I think WikiLeaks provides a couple of important lessons that inform some of the early debates about the place of technology and politics. And so one early expectation of people thinking about the new media and politics is that it would be one of the reasons that it would be very, very good for democracy and politics is that it would democratize the public sphere, right? Sort of shows like yours, blogs, citizen journalism, etc., would displace mainstream media and create a much more egalitarian field in which the barriers to creativity and the barriers to production and dissemination would be much, much lower. I think WikiLeaks, along with some other examples out there, illustrates how that's not exactly the case. And what we're seeing is how some effective new media works is as a complement in a kind of synergistic interaction with old and mainstream media, right? So WikiLeaks is part of the story, and it's as effective as it is in part because of its partnership with mainstream media organizations like The Guardian and El País and many others, right? So the operators of WikiLeaks were very, very clever in that they partnered with these other organizations and used their reputation and their capacity to vet a bunch of data and some of these cables for greater legitimacy for the project overall, greater credibility. And then also, I think it helped them defend against some of the accusations of complete indiscriminateness, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it, I think it does, and it leads to, and again, we only have a few minutes left, ultimately, this is kind of a policy prescription. You've talked about it a bit in terms of what you'd have advocates do. I guess I'll ask you this broader question, which is, given those views, do you think the public can impact corporate behavior through open society mechanisms?
I definitely think that it can. I think it does routinely. So I think when there are effective transparency systems in place, corporations will oftentimes respond to those. You know, the LA restaurant example that I hate to keep coming back to that one. We just don't have enough time on the show to offer a whole, you know, the many dozens of others that there are. You know, in that example, restaurants change their behavior. When the U.S. auto regulators make car manufacturers display the safety ratings, rollover probabilities, even fuel efficiencies on their cars, the cars get, guess what? They get safer. When bank regulators make banks tell the public who they're lending to in terms of their racial backgrounds, et cetera, guess what? It puts pressure on banks to become less discriminatory, and they do. So this information does there are many failed examples as well, but transparency can create a powerful lever for the public, for citizens, to change private sector behavior in ways that I believe are more socially productive and beneficial.
Archon Fung, a professor at the Kennedy School at Harvard, Ford Foundation professor of democracy and citizenship. Archon, thanks for joining us on the show. I do want to make sure that you put out there where people can learn more about your work. I know that you are at archonfung.net. Anywhere else where people can look for your writings?
Yeah, you know, the other place to look, and the website is in the process of getting revamped. It's pretty ugly now, but it'll be better in a few weeks. But the content will be equally rich, is transparencypolicy.net for people who are interested in transparency. And if you want to follow our group on Twitter, our group is the Transparency Policy Project. You can just follow Sunshine Policy.
Excellent. Archon Fung, professor at the Kennedy School at Harvard, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. It's been a great discussion. I, of course, invite you back in the future to continue the discussion. But I think we've had a good start today, and I look forward to following more of your work.
Well, thank you very much, Dave. It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on the show this quarter. As I mentioned earlier, next week, Micah Sifri of the Personal Democracy Forum will be on, author of the book WikiLeaks in the Age of Transparency. And then rounding out what I guess is a triumvirate on transparency issues, Professor Peter Gallison of Harvard University discussing his documentary Secrecy. For the remainder of the quarter, I'm looking forward to talking to Professor Lewis Hyde of Kenyon College, author of the book Common as Air. Professor Marcus Boone of York University discussing In Praise of Copying. Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of the book What Technology Wants. Professor Susan Shirk of the University of California, San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China. Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University discussing privacy and context. And Andrew Renz, research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School. As always, there are a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The best way is live on KZSU. But you can also get the show by podcast. And there are several ways you can pick up the podcast. You can go to Stanford.com. Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, where you can get the RSS feed. You can also get the show through Stanford CIS's iTunes page, where you can not only get Hearsay Culture, but also any other events occurring at CIS. And you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 140-odd shows, as well as see the schedule of upcoming guests. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback, and so forth at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you very much for listening to the show today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.